Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In a presidential administration that's just one astonishment after another, Donald Trump's posture toward Vladimir Putin continues to astonish. When Putin recently suggested that he wanted some high-level American officials sent off to Russia for interrogation, Trump was like, hey, why not?
What he did is an incredible offer. He offered to have the people working on the case come and work with their investigators with respect to the 12 people. I think that's an incredible offer. Okay, thank you.
Eventually, the White House walked that back, and the Senate passed a resolution unanimously, 98-0, against it. The most senior of the Americans that Putin wanted to get his hands on, if he really wanted to get his hands on him at all, was Michael McFaul. Putin hates Michael McFaul. McFaul went to Moscow in 2012 as the Obama administration's ambassador to Russia. But instead of being able to conduct business on a daily basis and make some progress, at least, on the U.S.-Russia relationship, McFaul became the object, almost on a daily basis, of Putin's increasingly anti-American resentment. And by the time McFaul left in 2014, he and his family had been subjected to surveillance, stalking, and harassment, treatment almost unthinkable for a diplomat.
Misha, привет.
Привет, пожалуйста.
Это Давид.
Хорошо.
I спoke with Michael McFaul last week. So, Michael, after Donald Trump and Putin's summit in Helsinki, you yourself were briefly held as a kind of geopolitical bargaining chip. How do you make sense of everything you've been through and everything we've been through in the last few weeks?
I don't know how to make sense of it, David, to be honest. I happen to be in Helsinki. I work for NBC News. I was part of the coverage. And when this first idea was floated, that in return for interrogating these GRU officers that have been indicted by Mr. Mueller with a lot of evidence to back up that indictment, Vladimir Putin floated a kind of equivalent idea in his mind of, we want to interview these dozen American officials. And at the press conference, he didn't name the officials. He just said, we think there are certain, in fact, he said American intelligence officers who had collaborated with Bill Browder, a famous American and now British citizen who used to do business in Russia. And he, on national world television, said, we believe that some American government officials colluded with Bill Browder to launder money out of Russia. And then a portion of that money, at the time he said it was $400 million, was given to the Clinton campaign. And I remember thinking, this is crazy. I hope our president just says this is ridiculous. And instead he said, well, this is a wonderful proposal. I look forward to getting back to you. And then several hours later, flying back on the plane from Helsinki to San Francisco, I started getting messages from Russian journalists saying, oh, by the way, you have been named as part of one of those officials, and very explicitly saying that they believe that I had broken Russian law.
How would you allegedly have broken the law?
Well, it's convoluted, but the reporting, the best reporting I've seen, suggests that I was the coordinator for gathering information about Magnitsky, the wrongful death of Sergei Magnitsky, a lawyer who was representing Bill Browder at the time. And that is correct, by the way. I worked at the White House. I was the point person for that. And we took the decision, the Obama administration did, and I was the lead, to sanction several Russian government officials that we thought were involved in the wrongful death of Sergei Magnitsky. They hate this Magnitsky Act, which calls for the sanctioning, travel ban, and freezing of assets of people, Russians, involved in human rights violations inside Russia. So it's now gone beyond just the case of Sergei Magnitsky.
Now, Michael, you were on the plane coming back from Helsinki. Was there ever any point in your mind where you thought, my God, Donald Trump might actually turn me over for questioning?
You know, not really. I want to be honest. I mean, I remember listening to it in real time and thinking this is crazy. But a few days later, when given the chance to correct the record, his press spokesperson said yet again from the podium in the White House, we're looking into this idea, and that was deeply disturbing to me then. And it stood in contrast to what I thought was a very professional statement from the State Department, basically saying this is all absurd. And then finally, the spokesperson Sanders had gave one more statement saying we are not entertaining this idea, and that was good news. But again, she called it a sincere gesture from Vladimir Putin, and that just underscores for me that they just don't understand who Vladimir Putin is and the methods he uses, both at home and abroad now. I mean, these are the methods they use against Russian opponents of them all the time, as you well know. But the fact that they would use these to go after people, you know, former ambassadors in California as an intimidation tactic, that's something new, Vladimir Putin.
Then the big question, and it's the big question about everything, is why? Why is Donald Trump behaving like this? Why does he show obeisance to Vladimir Putin? Why does he have nothing but great words to say about him when, in complete contradistinction, he behaves horribly, in many views, to our NATO allies, our European allies? Toward Vladimir Putin, it's another matter.
Yeah, I mean, that is the diagnosis for sure. And I don't have an answer to your question, David. I mean, I think he just personalizes diplomacy, and he's got it in his head that I want to be friends with Vladimir Putin, something he said all the way back in 2013, by the way, as a business person coming to Moscow when I was the U.S. ambassador. And somehow he thinks that, you know, a close relationship with Putin for him is going to be good for America. And he gets confused that you use relationships with other heads of state as a means to an end, not as the end in and of itself.
But Michael, the question then is why? Where you're not allowing your head to go, or at least publicly, is that there's some underlying reason for this, whether it's collusion, which is the Mueller investigation's task, or whether there are financial reasons, or whether there's something in terms of compromising material that Putin may have on Trump. Where do you go when your head starts to ask why?
Well, you know, I'm a political scientist. I'm a social scientist, right? So that's a hypothesis, and I want to see the data to support the hypothesis.
Right.
So I want to be careful about that. But let me say a couple of things, what I feel like I know and then what I want Mr. Mueller to answer. I know through my work and through my writings about Russia that Mr. Putin uses money all the time to create leverage. I've seen, you know, many instances of that, usually against Russians and his own government officials. That's a tactic that's a very classic tactic. What I don't know is, did he use it with the Trump administration? Trump organization, excuse me. And then second, on the more salacious stuff, when we went to Moscow with President Obama, we stayed at the Ritz-Carlton. And in order to have a private conversation with the president, we built a submarine-like structure, David. I'd never seen it before. This is incredible, a piece-by-piece ship to Russia just for the 2 days that we were in Moscow. That's what we did to make sure that when we were in the Ritz-Carlton, what we were saying or doing was not being recorded.
So what you're implying is that Donald Trump in 2013, when he went for the Miss Universe contest, did not take those precautions and may have opened himself up to compromising material in some way.
They have that capacity to do it. Whether they gathered it, I don't know. And obviously, I have no idea what businessman Trump did in the Ritz-Carlton.
Here's something interesting. Really, for me, confounding vibe that I get from Russian liberal friends. They think that people like you and me have gone a little crazy, that we've lost our heads and we're believing in Manchurian candidate conspiracies, when in fact their view is we're not capable of such mastery.
Yep.
How do you answer them?
Well, I say a couple of things. One is I think they underestimate the capabilities of their own government. But time and time again, including when I was in the government and before, I also think we tend to underestimate the Putin's willingness to do audacious things. And I've been thinking about this a lot in my own case, because the thing I'm worried about right now, to be honest with you, is that I will be indicted and then convicted in absentia of a crime I did not commit in Russia. And then the next time I show up in Spain or Mexico, there'll be a red notice for my name to be shipped to Russia. That is my chief concern now. And people say, oh, well, that's crazy. That will never happen. And I want to underscore, I believe it's a low probability event if I had to estimate it, right? But I also would tell you it was a low probability event that Putin would annex Crimea. I also would have told you it's a low probability event that he would prop up Assad. I also would tell you, because he used to tell me all the time, that it's a low probability event that Boris Nemtsov would be assassinated just a few steps from the walls of the Kremlin. I used to see him all the time.
A dissident figure who at one point was even a possibility of running for president of Russia.
Exactly.
He was shot right outside the Kremlin not long ago.
And he used to say to me all the time before he was killed, Mike, they'll never touch me. I'm too important. I'm the former first deputy prime minister. That can never happen to me. So I just want to remind people that there's a pattern here of more and more audacious actions. And the fact that Putin stood there with the whole world watching in Helsinki and accused American government officials of breaking Russian law, that was a pretty audacious act as well.
Now, if anything, many of the people that surround Donald Trump when it comes to Russia are more ferocious about this analysis than even you are. Fiona Hill is his Russia expert. You've met with her, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. John Bolton is certainly not a Russophile. So why do we see a press conference like we did in Helsinki and a policy like we do and a rhetoric like we do from the president?
Well, just to underscore how extraordinary this is, I think you're right. I think every senior administration official who works on Russia agrees with my analysis. And by the way, some of the things they've done have been more confrontational than what the Obama administration did. Providing lethal assistance to Ukraine, for instance, was a decision the Obama administration didn't make, but they did. But there's just one problem, and I think it was clear as day in Helsinki. There's one guy in the government that disagrees with them, and he happens to be the president of the United States. And so that means that you literally have two different policies towards Russia. You have the entire administration on one page, including people that work very closely with them, and the president. And that's, I think, makes for a very bad policy.
What's your greatest fear? Where is this taking us?
Well, on a personal level, we've discussed my greatest fear. I do not want to be indicted for a crime I didn't commit. And I hope my government, especially President Trump and the White House, will be more forceful in defending Americans. We didn't commit any crimes. And I just want him to say that forcefully so that Putin will have no illusions about playing that kind of game. It's important for people who are in the government right now to remember that part of your job, it's not your only job, is to defend Americans, all Americans, and not just treat this as some kind of partisan football game.
But in geopolitical terms, what are your great fears?
In broader terms, I just fear that there will be a momentum to move on and to forget about the fact that Putin annexed Crimea, to forget about the fact that he's supporting these separatists in eastern Ukraine, to forget about what he did in our 2016 elections. And I think that would be a mistake, because I think right now we need a policy of containment. We need to contain that belligerent behavior.
Michael McFaul, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Michael McFaul is a professor of political science at Stanford University, and he's the author of a recent memoir, From Cold War to Hot Peace. The Capitol continues now to be rattled by Trump's statements on Russia, including many in the president's own party, and we'll get the view from D.C. with Susan Glasser. That's up next.
Hi. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Earlier, we talked about American sanctions on Russia and how they helped to motivate Vladimir Putin's meddling in the 2016 election. But in the wake of the very troubling spectacle in Helsinki and the threat, the very real threat of Russian meddling in the 2018 midterms, the Senate is now mulling even more sanctions because the attitude toward Russia in Congress is quite different than in the Oval Office. Marco Rubio, a Republican from Florida, and Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, a Democrat, have co-sponsored a bill called the Deter Act. Now, that stands for Defending Elections from Threats by Establishing Red Lines. The legislation says this: if the Director of National Intelligence determines that a foreign power has interfered in an election, it would trigger a series of crippling sanctions against key sectors of that adversary nation's economy. Every week for NewYorker.com, Susan Glasser writes her letter from Trump's Washington. She just sat down with Senator Chris Van Hollen on Wednesday.
I have to say, we're having this conversation in your office, which has lots of excellent Maryland historical figures on the wall. But the figure that I'm looking at is this little Matryoshka doll of Vladimir Putin that is sitting behind you. I'm wondering on the backstory of that. What is it like to have Vladimir Putin staring at you every time you type on your computer?
I'm trying to remember where I even got this, actually. And
is it all Putin in there?
Oh, it looks like there's a series of
Yeltsin and
figures that go back. Exactly. These are the sort of, this is the Russian dynasty in terms of leadership going over many years. So it looks like it starts out with earlier Russian leaders. And of course, you know, the thing about Vladimir Putin is that we're dealing with someone who's a former KGB agent and somebody who is very calculating. And that's why we all worry when Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin go on a walk and nobody knows what they discussed, because we've already seen that President Putin and his team have come back and said, hey, we have certain agreements that we reached, whereas the U.S. team is flying blind. And that's a very scary proposition for the country.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of an interesting coda to the bill that we're discussing. You and Marco Rubio are kind of an unlikely pairing, obviously, Republican presidential candidate from 2016. He's always been very outspoken in his views on Russia. Why did you two team up?
Well, we teamed up because we are both very concerned about protecting the integrity of our democracy, especially after what happened in 2016. And clearly, President Trump has done nothing to protect the integrity of the 2018 elections. It became important to lots of people, I think both Republicans and Democrats alike, that we take measures to protect the integrity of the 2018 elections. And Senator Rubio and I had introduced this bill a number of months ago to do exactly that, called the Deter Act.
Right. So this is back in January. But, you know, tell us what it was like after Helsinki. You got, I think it was 8 new sponsors right away. And many of them were senior Republicans like Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Did they just start beating down your door, or you and Senator Rubio thought, well, gee, we have an opportunity here to make our bill the response?
Well, it was a little bit of both. I mean, Senator Rubio and I recognized that after what happened in Helsinki, people really need to get together to actually do something to protect our democracy. And you found other, you know, Republican and Democratic senators also wanting to take action, because it is hard to oppose the idea of passing legislation to deter Putin from interfering in our election. So I think there was a convergence around this bill. And now the key is to make sure we maintain the momentum to get it done.
Well, that's right. So you seem to have a somewhat important patron in the Senate Majority Leader. He's not usually someone who's a big fan of your legislation, but Senator Mitch McConnell has mentioned your measure twice and suggested he'd like it to move through and get hearings. Does that mean the Republican leadership here in the Senate is finding a way to block in and constrain the president of their own party?
Well, the jury's still out on that question, and that's why it's really important that we keep the pressure up. I was glad to see Senator McConnell take interest in the bill. He's directed the Senate Banking Committee, which I serve on, and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, to have hearings and move forward. But the real test will be whether or not we passed legislation like the Deter Act. I've been disappointed that we've not been able to pass a very simple resolution put forward by Senator Flake and Senator Coons that would simply back up our own intelligence agencies. We did get the almost unanimous vote to say it was a really bad idea to turn over our diplomats to Putin for interrogation. But I do think that what you've seen post-Helsinki is people around the country really wanting senators who are going to hold President Trump accountable. It's not that they want, you know, people who are in full resistance mode in states that Trump won. That's not what I'm saying. But the public is worried about Trump. Even Trump supporters who continue to back him have some anxiety about his conduct. And that translates into them wanting some kind of check on the president. And so I think that gives Republican senators a little bit more room to operate. We're also seeing this a little bit on the Trump tariff policy, where it's boomeranged on a lot of farmers in states that Trump won. Mm-hmm. And you're actually seeing, you know, Republican senators step up on that issue. So I think you've seen accumulation of events, which may be allowing a little more room to stand up to Trump. Again, jury's still out, and the test will be whether anything actually passes the Congress.
Well, what about on Russia specifically? You have seen over the last year and a half a dramatic switch in the polls, and where Democrats now are expressing views that are much more hawkish toward Russia and much more skeptical of Vladimir Putin. And Republicans, traditionally, ever since the Cold War, the party of hawks, really not just flip-flopping a little bit, but enormously. These are now lopsided poll results on exactly the opposite side of where they were in the Obama administration.
There's no doubt. I mean, you've got a large group of voters out there who are for Trump, no matter what Trump says or does. And so when Trump cozies up to Putin, they defend Trump. But I do believe that—
So you don't think they love Putin as much as they love Trump?
I think that they love Trump and are taking Trump's word that, you know, Putin's a great guy. I mean, this is part of the strategy that Trump has launched to undermine the whole notion that there are really facts out there. And he's got supporters out there that continue to back him.
So putting your campaign chief hat on for a second here, is this really good politics for Democrats? I mean, you know, is there a possibility that actually emphasizing Russia too much as an issue is not good for Democrats this fall? Or conversely, actually teaming up with Republicans and giving them the chance to show them as responsible actors might actually be benefiting them more than it's benefiting your Senate candidates?
I think for the most part, Democrats, at least Democrats who are running in states that Trump won, are focused on the issues that are foremost in the minds of their voters. So they are talking about the healthcare prices. In a lot of these farm states, they're talking about the fact that the tariffs are coming around and hitting farmers right between the eyes. You know, now Trump is proposing an $11 billion bailout fund, taxpayer finance bailout fund. So I think those are the issues that are front and center. However, on the question of, you know, Trump and his Russia ties, yes, people have used it as a reminder that it's important to have an independent senator who will hold a president accountable and make sure they stand up more for U.S. interests. We've seen one of our challengers down in Tennessee, Phil Bredesen, is running an ad right now about the negative impact of President Trump's tariffs on Tennessee whiskey. He's also made it clear that his number one priority, Phil Bredesen's, is the people of Tennessee.
Do you think that one of the effects of the Trump era will be a Congress, and in particular a Senate, that is more assertive on foreign policy? I mean, you know, over the last really couple generations, the trend has all been in the other direction of Congress essentially ceding its role in foreign affairs to an ever more powerful executive.
I hope so. I hope this will be an opportunity for the Congress, Senate, and House to reclaim some of that authority. Of course, last year, the Congress did pass the CATSA legislation, imposing sanctions on Russia, as well as North Korea and Iran. That was really over the objections of President Trump. He didn't veto it.
Which is fascinating, because now when President Trump and his advisors say, well, we are the toughest administration ever on Russia, they cite those sanctions, which were in fact initiated up here on Capitol Hill as a response to the concerns that President Trump would get rid of the existing sanctions.
And they've been dragging their feet on implementing a lot of the sanctions in that legislation. Which is why in the legislation that Senator Rubio and I have introduced, we have a trigger mechanism. If the DNI determines there's been interference, you have this automatic set of sanctions go into effect.
Well, I'm glad you brought up this provision about the Director of National Intelligence. We all saw that viral video clip of Dan Coats reacting in real time on the stage at the Aspen Security Forum to the news that President Trump had invited Vladimir Putin back for a second summit. And then he was forced to put out that very kind of abject apology. I didn't mean anything by it. Wasn't trying to insult the president over the weekend. Your bill that you're sponsoring with Marco Rubio would, if it passed as is and has the Director of National Intelligence as the trigger for your things, it would be seen as even more of a tweak and a jab at President Trump, even though you wrote it long before this incident.
We did write it long before this incident. And the whole purpose of that is to have a, you know, very clear decision based on the assessment of the intelligence community. Of course, the DNI represents all the different parts of the intelligence community, so we'll be getting input from the CIA and other folks in that community. Whether or not Russia interferes or not is a factual question, and we want to make sure we get a factual assessment.
Just the other day, we've heard a lot of post-Helsinki spin from the president himself via his Twitter feed and in other ways. He tweeted that actually President Putin wants to help Democrats in the upcoming midterm elections. Any signs of that? Would you welcome any assistance, you know, make right from the 2016 intervention?
We, of course...
Big smile
outrageous,
on the Senator's face.
Yes, right. Putin, yeah, we heard that he wants to help Democrats. Look, it's outrageous that Putin would get involved in the United States election for any party or any person. And I know the president tweeted that out just the other day, but I recall at the Helsinki press conference, President Putin was asked who he supported in the last election in 2016, and he said he supported Donald Trump. And look, Putin got the person he wanted, and now that person, Donald Trump, has been bending over backwards to kowtow to Putin and the Russians. And I think it's got to be alarming for every American. And I know it's alarming for many of my Senate Republican colleagues. The test will be not whether you're alarmed privately or even whether you, you know, make some public comments, but whether you're willing to take action.
So, you know, the conventional wisdom has been that Democrats have a strong chance of retaking the House, but a much more difficult and uncertain road in the Senate. What would you currently assess the chances of a Democratic take back of the Senate?
Well, I'm not going to make any specific prediction here, but here what I will say is that the path to a Democratic Senate majority has definitely gotten larger over the last year. I would say that if you look at the situation right now, there is clearly a path to a Senate Democratic majority. It's certainly not, you know, a super highway, but there is a there is a path to getting there, and I think increasingly, you know, people are feeling squeezed on some of these issues, including, you know, the loss of income as a result of the boomeranging effect of some of the tariff policies, as well as rising healthcare costs.
A path, not a superhighway. I guess we'll have to come back and check in with you in a couple months and see what happened.
It's great talking to you, Susan.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, talking with Susan Glasser, a staff writer based in Washington. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Next week, Patrick Keefe brings us an extraordinary story about a notorious gangster in Amsterdam and the sister who decided to betray him. I hope you'll join us. I'm David Remnick. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Yeh, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.